The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly European Roundup. Serie A, Lazio's weird COVID test results, Zlatan keeps on keeping on, and some Atalanta explaining to do from Bandini. Bundesliga, Bayern win der Klassiker again, we'll get out the Giroud-meter for a glorious Mönchengladbach scorpion kick, and there's a striker who calls the police Schweiner on his Instagram. In La Liga, Messi's on the bench, Real concede three penalties, and Granada have to field the kids. Elsewhere, someone wants Barry to give them an in-depth look at the title race in Belgium, there's a dubious handball in Norway, and a critique of one of the panel's bedroom posters. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry Glendening, nice to see you bright and early this morning. Did you enjoy the live show?
I did indeed, Max. I'd like to thank everyone who purchased a ticket and tuned in. It was good fun.
I especially like to thank the person who purchased a ticket and then forgot and watched a documentary on hospitals instead. But there we go. On the panel today, Nikki Bandini. Hello, Nikki.
Morning.
Thank you for your contribution to the halftime performance. Same goes to you, Archie Rinter. Who knew Archie could sing? That's a lovely voice you have.
Thanks, Max. Morning.
Thank you for showing us the contents of your fridge, Lars Sivertsen.
That's okay. Do we know which hospital it was? Because, I mean, it could have been a very good documentary. Maybe it just was... You just had to prioritise, you know, we're all really busy these days.
Absolutely right. Now, if you do, if you missed the live show and you still, that glowing testimonial means that you still want to watch it, there's a link that you can watch if you go onto my Twitter, I tweeted it out, and you can still get it and watch it over the next week. Let's start with this question from Matt. At the start of the season, everyone gave their percentage chances of the dominant clubs not winning their title this season. I'd be interested to hear the updated version of that. So let's start with Archie, when I think you said it was 0%. I presume it stays at 0%.
I can't do minus 0%, can I? No, it's still 0%.
Perfect. Nikki, Serie A, is there... I think the chances were small, you thought, but the season, and we'll get into it in detail in a sec, but there seems to be a tiny bit of a chance.
It's just been Juventus for 9 years, so did I include anyone else in that
game? No, it's do you still think Juve will win the league or not?
I still have them as favourites, but I would say the percentage chance that it could be someone else has crept up, which is weird because the team who I thought before the season was most likely to challenge them was Inter, who have done worse than expectations, are behind Juventus. But Juventus aren't playing great so far under Andrea Pirlo. And in the meantime, we've got Milan who've shown up and are playing really well. We have Napoli playing to a level higher than I expected from them this season. Maybe even a wild card like Roma back in the mix. So we're not talking about traditionally small clubs, but we're talking about clubs that I wouldn't have put in that title conversation at the beginning of the season. So I don't know, maybe like, I don't know, like 30%.
Lars, obviously you watch every single football match from every single league. You're in the Sid Lowe role.
Just feel very
currently.
Close to the truth that actually, Max.
I always wonder how you get to watch MLS. Like, where's the time for you to get to MLS? It's on at a funny time.
It's because I'm a night person, Max. I haven't, truth be told, I haven't watched that much this season. But yeah, Philly just won the Supporters' Shield, you'll be delighted to know. The Philadelphia Union.
To be honest, Philadelphia have done some good things in the last few days, I would argue. What would you say the percentage chance of a non-Real Madrid-Barcelona title in Spain?
I mean, I'm going to sit on the fence and not give a percentage, but I think there's a real chance. I think the High Liga, as you'd say, and seeing as I am sort of channeling Sid, would have to add some caveats here, which is that both Real Madrid and Barcelona are capable of just getting their act together and running away with it. But both look really vulnerable. Barcelona are a bit of a mess, a massive mess off the pitch, but also occasionally a bit messy on it. And Real Madrid have several weaknesses in their squad, many of which they showed against Valencia just this weekend, so we'll talk about that later. But, you know, I think there is a real chance. And with Atleti being undefeated in the first seven, you know, while Felix really stamping his authority on that team there, I think there's a very good chance, actually, that we could have someone else than the big two win it.
Haven't Barcelona been a bit messy on the pitch for, like, 15 years?
Oh, please, please.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, you're forgiven, but no more. That's your last chance. Can we start in Italy? Because, and before we talk about, you know, Milan being top and Sassuolo being second and Juve not being in the top four, the situation at the sort of Lazio COVID situation is fascinating, and correct me if I'm wrong here, They drew with Juve at the weekend, but there's an issue with their COVID testing whereby players who've tested positive under the test that UEFA used and have missed Champions League games have tested negative for Serie A games days before, days after, and have played in those games.
That's exactly what's happened. I mean, specifically, the one who we've got the most clarity on is Ciro Immobile, who's obviously a pretty important player. We're talking about the European Golden Shoe winner last season. He was tested as positive before by UEFA. UEFA do their testing for the Italian clubs through a company called Synlab. Immobile tested positive with them. And then in midweek, when they played Torino after that, he tested negative. That was through Lazio's testing facility that they've been using, which is a company called Futura Diagnostica, which is based in Avellino. He tested negative. He played against Torino and he scored. And then a couple of days later, he has to get tested before the Champions League game against Zenit, and he's positive again in UEFA's testing. It's thrown open like a huge, huge can of worms, because Lazio subsequently this weekend had their sort of regular testing done again through Futura Diagnostica, and they were saying literally on Saturday, so they're playing on Sunday night, and on Saturday they are saying, we think we've got the full squad at our disposal. And players who had tested positive in midweek, which included some important players, not just Immobile, but Thomas Rakosha, the goalkeeper, Lucas Leiva, they were all presumed to be ready to play against Juventus. They all came to Formello, which is the Lazio training ground, on Saturday. When Simone Inzaghi gave his pre-game press conference, he's talking about having these players in his team. Then on Saturday afternoon, we get these test results back from another testing facility, Campus Biomedico, which is the facility that Roma have been using. It's based in Rome. And these players are all positive and they're not going to play in the game against Juventus. They're all sent home from the training facility. It's a really serious and delicate situation that Lazio now find themselves in. They're one of only two clubs in all of Serie A that has been doing its testing outside of its home region. Every other club has been doing it within their home region. And that matters because if you do your testing in your home region, then the company that conducts your testing has to report test results to the local health authority. It's like a legal obligation. Because Lazio are doing theirs outside of that of their regional authority, they are responsible for reporting test results to the local health authority. That's their responsibility. The club has to do it. So now on Saturday, you have federal authorities raiding Lazio's training ground and seizing swab test results on all of their players, all of their staff, also requesting information on all communications that have been sent between Lazio and the local health authority. So this is, and I should stress that for now, the only individual under police investigation is the head of Futura Diagnostica. No one at Lazio is officially under investigation right now. However, all of this information about their testing is being taken by federal authorities to be looked at. So it's a serious, potentially criminal case we're talking about, because there are laws in Italy specifying that anyone who's responsible for encouraging the spread of the virus, whether through negligence, medical negligence, or through deliberate actions, they can face criminal charges. So you have this very serious federal inquiry going on. And at the same time, of course, on top of that, you now have a sporting inquiry with, you know, the Italian Football Federation saying, well, this is interesting. How come these players were positive in Europe and not in Italy? And it's not just Torino who they played in the middle asking about this, but Bologna who played against Lazio right before the game against Zenit are also asking questions about whether players could have played in their game who shouldn't have. It's a big case that is not going to resolve quickly, I don't expect. Lazio are defending themselves very firmly. They're saying, look, you know, we got our tests done. We've followed the protocol. We do what we're supposed to. There's no rules that they shouldn't use a testing facility outside their local region. But until we have some more clarity, it's going to hang over the club pretty heavily, this case, because, again, the implications are serious, not just on a sporting level, but on a legal level.
On the pitch, you know, the draw, the weather looked lovely in Rome, I thought. Juve should probably have won this game, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, so to sort of look at it from a purely footballing context for a second, to sort of strip away anything about what the club, the position the club finds itself in, I think it's remarkable the results that Lazio have achieved while sort of dealing with some of these absentees, the two games away in Europe against Club Brugge and Zenit, playing without a host of really important starters, managed to draw both of them, puts them in a really strong position in that group, having already beaten Dortmund at home to begin the group. And this game away to Juventus, sorry, at home to Juventus, I expected them to lose it. And with Cristiano Ronaldo coming back, and they probably should have done. Ronaldo put Juventus ahead early. He hit the woodwork. Juventus were largely on top, especially at the beginning. But Lazio hung around. Lazio didn't let themselves get, take that sort of knockout hit. And they end up equalizing through Felipe Caicedo, who has really quite a habit of popping up with these last minute goals. I think he's scored, I can't remember the number anymore.
It's five.
After the 90th minute in the last 12 months, which is quite some going. This one was one of my favourite footballing moments of the weekend. Again, taking it just out of all of the context that there is around it. Because, again, we're in the last minute of injury time and Lazio get a throw-in on the same side that the manager's dugout is. And Adam Maricic, who's trying to take it, is looking backwards, looking for someone who's open. And Simone Inzaghi runs up and literally shoves him. The manager shoves him to face forward up the pitch. Subsequently, he lobs the ball into Joaquin Correa. Correa gets the ball past like four players. Really nice dribble from Correa and tees up Caicedo to score. So it was a fun moment of Simone Inzaghi as manager, quite physically directing his team to do the right thing.
What's the take on Pirlo then? Sort of four draws in six league games. I mean, does he get the kind of, they sort of talk over here that, you know, Lampard gets sort of a free ride in the press and to an extent Solskjaer, I guess, because they're sort of club legends. Is it the same with...
I thought Lampard got a tough time because he's English, Max. That's what I heard.
I think he gets too tough a time from us. So now I feel like I need to defend Frank Lampard because he gets an easy ride elsewhere and then he gets a really tough time on the pod. Then I start to feel guilty. I mean, it doesn't keep me awake at night. But how's Pirlo treated?
I think he's had a relatively gentle ride so far. I haven't seen anything yet that really makes me think this team has taken some great new direction under Pirlo. And that's kind of what they were hoping for, not just to sort of maintain the status quo, still win some games. The idea was to develop a new identity, an identity that's linked to Pirlo, to this idea of playing attacking football, the identity that they hoped Sarri would give them, I guess, last season. And to me, it looks like the same old Juventus that hasn't got clear enough ideas and too often is just waiting for, since he arrived, Ronaldo to fix them for them.
Adam says, what's happening at AC Milan? I thought it was 2020, not the 1990s.
Well, it's a reasonable thing to say, given that Zlatan is the man at Milan and he wasn't there in the 90s, was he? But he's 39 years old and currently Serie A's top scorer. They're top of the league is the first thing to say, in case anyone didn't know that. They could have gone 4 points clear, I think, if they won this weekend, which they didn't against Verona. They haven't lost a game in Serie A since lockdown. That's 19 games now. They did need a late equaliser to get through in this one. They're a really young team. They've got some brilliant players. I think the middle of the park in particular, Ismaël Benacer and Frank Kessié, are really one of the better midfield tandems in all of Italy right now, and early 20s, both of them. And then you've got Zlatan, who's on this late career tear with everything to prove. And this game at the weekend was really sort of it was one of his worst since he went back to Milan. He missed a penalty. He hit the woodwork. He had a goal that he set up was disallowed because he handballed in the build-up to it. And he still got his goal in the 92nd minute to equalise. He's got something about him at the moment. He's just always finding the way to be decisive, even in a game like this where he's not playing that well.
Can I ask you about Atalanta, Nicky? Because a lot of hipsters started following Atalanta and telling all their friends that Atalanta were great, even though they never watched Atalanta, basically because you said they were great. And then obviously they lost one football match quite badly and people got angry with us because they got hammered by Liverpool.
A team that has outperformed like hugely for two seasons running has not played great so far this season. I just think it really hasn't. Like Atalanta's defensively have been atrocious. But as soon as it happens, throw Nicky under the bus for saying that they played well the last two seasons.
But also clearly the people giving us, or let's face it, Nicky, stick for this, have clearly not been listening to anything that we've been saying, because no one's ever accused Atalanta of being just impenetrable defensive fortress. I mean, that's part of their appeal because of the way they play. They will occasionally get a tonking because they're very open. And sometimes if a team, you know, gets the run of them, then that happens.
Last season, they got walloped 4-0, 4-1 by Dynamo Zagreb.
If you lose, 5-0 to an English club, it cancels you as a club. Like, it's over. It doesn't matter what happened before. I don't know if you heard about RB Leipzig. Like, they're no longer a club. I mean, some would argue, were they ever a club? But
yeah, I'm detecting a lot of defensiveness from our continental correspondents here.
Atlanta have had their worst run of form in a while, I would say. I would also point out that they've often started seasons slowly under Gasperini. It's actually been like a really sort of regular trend under Gasperini, and they've often come good by the end of the season. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt still.
I'd love to think somewhere else in Europe there's a sort of the Englisher podcasting where some listener has like, oh, you kept telling me Liverpool were good, and I tuned in when they played Aston Villa, and I don't know what you're talking about. They're so rubbish. So overrated.
Nicky, you wanted to talk about Henrik Mkhitaryan, who scored a hat-trick at the weekend.
Yeah, well, Roma have been playing, like, another team, again, interesting this season, playing better than I necessarily expected, but Paulo Fonseca's got them going in a good direction. They lost Edin Dzeko. He's the latest high-profile coronavirus diagnosis, so he's out for however long it takes. And that was a big concern because they haven't really got another real striker in the squad, to be honest. Mkhitaryan popped up with a hat-trick against Genoa, which I saw reported in some places as the first hat-trick of his career, and I checked and it's nothing like the first hat-trick of his career. I think it's his first, like, in one of the really big leagues, he didn't get one in the Premier League maybe, and he hadn't had one in Serie A until now. But yeah, he had a good hat-trick, header and two off the right foot, not quite the perfect hat-trick. I actually was a bit sad because I thought his best effort the whole game was in the first half. He had a wicked half volley that was from the edge of the box that would have been better than any of those goals, but a good game against, I will sort of add to that, a really bad Genoa team. They're really bad.
Before we move to Germany, Robert says, can we get an explanation as to what's going on in Italy with the situation where certain clubs are not allowed to release players for international duty?
Yeah, this was another mess this week, to be honest with you. Italy is not like one neat country in the way that lots of other countries in Europe are. Italy has, in the great scheme of things, only been a country for a relatively short amount of time. And that is reflected in its politics. You still have very strong influence for regional governments in Italy. And you have a lot of authority in this pandemic for the regional health authorities. And we had this chaotic situation heading into the international round where certain local health authorities were looking at teams that had coronavirus outbreaks and going, no, we don't think it's safe for anyone in your playing group to travel. And when I talk about regional, it's as specific as within Rome, the local health authority that is responsible for the area, which represents Roma, they said, nope, players can't travel. The one representing Lazio said, no, it's okay, which is why Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, who has a quite important Euro 2020 playoff against Scotland to play, managed to travel. It's something that's gone down really badly with some of the clubs whose players were allowed to travel. Inter, Beppe Marotta sort of turned around and said, this is not on, this is going to falsify the championship. Because effectively, if a team's players aren't traveling, they're resting and getting this time in a really sort of busy part of the schedule. So it's a mess, like so much else at the moment.
Absolutely. While we're on sort of international messes, the Danish mink are affecting things for England. Albania has emerged as the leading candidate to host England's Nations League game against Iceland next week, obviously. The game's in doubt because of the UK government's new travel ban on non-UK visitors coming from Denmark because of the mink. Iceland are set to play Denmark in Copenhagen 3 days before facing England at Wembley. If the ban remains in place, Albania's Football Association is willing to provide a neutral venue. I mean, I suppose England v Iceland in Albania is sort of how football goes in 2020, but it's a bit weird, but obviously we'll keep you posted. Lars, you look like you're about to say something.
Just like all the stories about these, they keep being illustrated by like stock photos of mink looking really concerned, which is a little bit funny. Also tragic because they're going to have to cull the mink. I mean, there's something like, you know, 17 million mink that they're going to have to put down now because of this thing in Denmark. So I guess there's going to be a huge crash in mink prices. So, I mean,
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll concentrate on the Bundesliga. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Archie, it's your time to shine. Let's do the Bundesliga. Dortmund 2, Bayern 3 in Der Klassiker. And you were there.
I was there. And I was at the game between them both back in May as well. And I have to say, it still doesn't feel right having such a big game with no fans. It still feels like something of a PlayStation experience. And yeah, it feels weird, just, you know, all the big meaning to it. And you're just kind of like, but there's no one here. You don't sense the swings in a game in the same way where you think that the fans would be able to rouse their team in certain moments. That said, it was a very good game, which Dortmund come off the back of feeling that they should have won. Erling Haaland in particular. Lars, we need to talk, because what's happened to the Haaland hammer? Like, he was hesitating when he was getting in front of goal at certain moments on Saturday. And I actually spoke to him after the game, and he was blaming himself almost entirely for the defeat. But it seems like he's just he's lost that bit of decisiveness in front of goal, and he realizes, oh, hang on a minute, Manuel Neuer's in goal here. I maybe have to pick my spot just that little bit more.
I do wonder if it was a case of him trying a bit too hard in this game, actually, because one of the sort of refreshing things about Haaland, as I think I've said on the pod before, is that he just likes to sort of whack the ball as hard as he can sometimes and just see how it goes. Whereas this, he had a few shooting chances where, yeah, he took a touch too many and he should have just had a go. And I do wonder if it's just because he's, as you'll have noticed, an incredibly self-critical guy. So he'll be very troubled by this. But yeah, he did score one goal in the end. I think there was a lot of people on social media saying that we saw the difference between him and Lewandowski in game, and I think that's actually a fair comment, because you saw Lewandowski is so clinical, he's so smooth in everything he does, whereas Haaland, he remains an absolute force of nature, but he is quite rough around the edges still. And yeah, I think he it did look like he was trying to force it a little bit, which is unlike him.
Lewandowski's 300th competitive game for Bayern, 259 goals so far. You make the right point, Lars. He doesn't really actually have a right to win that header, does he? I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant header.
He doesn't, but he's going up against Mats Hummels, who was a doubt for this game with a hamstring injury. It was the big question before the game, will Mats Hummels start or not? And it's not the first time in the recent history of this fixture where Mats Hummels has forced himself to play when he's not been 100% fitness-wise. There was a time when Dortmund beat Bayern 3-2, and I was at that game. That was Jadon Sancho's first edition of this fixture, if I remember correctly, as well. And I just remember Sancho steaming past him in the second half, and you could tell that Hummels was absolutely breathless. And I think he's put his pride before the team in this case again, because actually, if you look at all three Bayern goals that were scored, he plays a role in them. Even, okay, David Alaba's deflected free kick, but he misses the tackle on Serge Gnabry, which leads to that free kick. He misses the header with Robert Lewandowski, and he misjudged, albeit it's not easy when Leon Goretzka is running at you at a million miles per hour and you've got Leroy Sané steaming in behind you. That, like, you know, that's not an easy decision to take, and nor an easy tackle to time. But that said, you wonder whether a fully fit Hummels would have helped Dortmund a bit more. Lewandowski, I mean, we should mention he scored two disallowed goals as well in this game. So he's on point, as he has been this season, 11 goals in 7 games. And he's being mentioned in the same breath as Gerd Müller. Gerd Müller holds the record for Bundesliga goals in a season, which is 40, but he's also out in the lead for the all-time scoring on 365. And you wonder the form that Lewandowski's in, the shape that he's in physically. He's 32 now, whether he can catch Gerd Müller. Lewandowski, by the way, because Gerd Müller's condition with Alzheimer's has been reported to be not in the greatest state right now. Robert Lewandowski paid homage to Gerd Müller last week, which was also a very classy touch.
Josh Kimmich was carried off in this game. How bad's the injury, and how bigger implications does that have on Bayern? How important is he to them?
Huge. He is part of the axis of this team. He is a future captain of Germany and of Bayern. Ike, he has this terrier-like quality, and I thought it was apt that Hans-Joachim Watzke, the CEO of Dortmund, was saying before this game that Kimmich is the one player that he really doesn't like going up against, because he always seems to score against them, but it's just his general mentality. He's the sort of player that you want on your side, but you will despise him if you're going up against him. Bayern do have options in the middle of the park to replace him. Corentin Tolisso came on. He's the first option. They've also got Mark Rocca, who they brought in from Espanyol this summer, plus Javi Martinez. But I think Tolisso is the most realistic replacement. I've not mentioned what injury he's got yet, which is a meniscus tear.
Oh, I did that, and that's really affected me for a long time.
Oh, good. So...
Really has. Do you know what? I've got so many knee supports. I'll send one to Josh Kimmich. It might be a placebo. It might be a placebo, but it really does make you feel better on the pitch.
No, of course, he picked up the injury whilst trying to tackle Erling Haaland. So there's a salutary tale for defenders all across the world.
Right. But in terms of how long it looks like he's going to be out for, that's still up in the air. I think I could see Bayern being on the safe side with it, because he's such an important player for them to have for the second half of the season. I wouldn't be surprised if he's kept out now until the new year. But yeah, it looks like it's going to be at least a month before we see him coming back.
Terrier-like qualities. Yeah, as producer Ian points out, he was born in Rottweil. So...
Get out.
Yeah. Oh, no.
I did not know that.
My Football Weekly Live, the whiteboard with my Football Weekly Live. It's a bad easel that my wife has.
That observation has actually broken the set.
It's broken the set of yesterday's live show. Anyway, Marco Reus had such a great chance at the end. I mean, that has changed the whole story of the game, doesn't it, Archie?
Yeah, but with the chances that Dortmund had, you could have pointed to quite a few moments. I think the big turning point for me was when Erling Haaland had his third biggest chance, his third big chance of the game, which was just after half time. The game was at 1-1, and he chooses the option between shooting and crossing, and Bayern goes straight down the other end and score through Lewandowski. But yeah, with Marco Reus, he's a player who they're having to use a little bit more carefully, what with his injury record. You saw that chance, Max. If it's a first-time volley on his foot...
Yeah, okay.
It's not easy.
No.
There's one other point I'd bring up, which was which would be the impact of David Alaba. He's been in the headlines a lot in Germany in the past week, because the Bayern president, Herbert Heine, said that they'd withdrawn the contract offer they put in to David Alaba and his agent, Pini Zahavi, because they were demanding too much. Basically, Alaba wants wage parity with the top earners at the club, Manuel Neuer and Robert Lewandowski, and Bayern, I think, just about understandably are saying, well, no, that's not where we see you. And I don't think either side has retreated enough. And as a result, Bayern took away the rug from underneath Alaba, which Hansi Flick, the coach, wasn't happy about, particularly before this big week for Bayern, which they then went and won 6-2 in Salzburg and 3-2 in Dortmund, so really affected them badly. But at the same time, it's still a saga which I think is going to run. His most likely destination, I think, will be Spain, somewhere like Real or Barca, particularly if there's no transfer fee to pay. But that said, I think we've all seen what the financial state of players in Barcelona right now. So I wonder whether they'll be prepared to pay 20 million euros in contract, which is around about what Alaba supposedly wants right now. But yeah, him scoring was a good answer to the critics, and he played well at centre-back.
Here's a question from Alex. On the Higuita Giroud scale, where would you rate Valentino Lazaro's scorpion kick? This was a consolation. So unfair, it's a consolation goal for Borussia Mönchengladbach. It made the score 4-3 in injury time at Leverkusen. It is his first goal for them.
I think it is, yeah. I was right down the other end of the stadium at that point when it happened. I just remember releasing a very high-pitched sound. Like, it's one of those things that when you see a goal like that,
I
was going to say, that sounds like most noises you make. I know exactly what you mean. That involuntary, occasionally there's a goal of such brilliance or so different that you can't help yourself but sort of make some sort of noise.
Well, exactly. And I had the chance to speak to Lazaro after the game, and he was in a difficult situation because obviously he's just scored the goal of his life, but his team's just lost 4-3. And so I tried to coax something out of him. I was like, look, you must be excited by this. Let's talk about the goal. And he had the tone of somebody who just walked his dog. But it's an amazing goal. And I don't know whether it'll be the goal of the season, because I think goal of the season is as much about the moment as it is about the technical ability, but I don't think anyone's going to beat that in terms of technical ability.
Leipzig are second. Can they mount any sort of challenge, do you think?
No.
Okay. Let's talk about Union Berlin. Talk about Max Kruse.
What do you know about Max Kruse, Max?
I don't know a lot about him. I mean, obviously, what I meant to say is, I obviously know a lot, but for those who don't.
Okay.
I may have used that line before.
So, when people in Germany talk about a maverick in the Bundesliga, then the guy they go to is Max Kruse. This is the guy who had the camouflage sports car when he was at Borussia Mönchengladbach, likes to play poker in his downtime, once allegedly left €75,000 in the back of a taxi in Berlin after winning in a poker tournament, was told to cut down on his Nutella eating when he was at Wolfsburg.
How much Nutella do you have to be eating for it to have a real impact on your elite footballing career?
Well, thing is, he was still pretty good as well. And this is the thing, like, there's something of a media obsession over here with him, which I'm perpetuating now, because he's got these things about him which always seem to pop up. I have to say as well, did you hear what happened with the Russia striker Artem Zhuba this weekend?
I think we all did.
Well, once upon a time, there was a similar kind of video. We didn't see quite as much of Max Kruse as well.
Okay. I think you just say Zhuba was having a nice time. I believe that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
In his birthday suit. Anyway. What this is to say is that Max Kruse has had his scrapes with the law, maybe even as recently as last week when he was caught going at just over 40 in a 30 zone. We've all been there, and was fined and will be fined a whopping €25. But what caught the eye is that he's putting all this on Instagram and calling the police pigs, Schweine, and saying like, how can you put a speeding camera 5 meters behind a sign of kids playing? He's like, it's just sneaky. Yeah, and all of this is against the background of him now playing for Union Berlin, who are, I would say, modest, hardworking, unflashy as a club. And there's nothing to doubt Max Kruse being hardworking, I have to say, or his professionalism. To the extent that he's never even tried alcohol in his life. He caused some headlines over here a month ago when he put on Instagram a meeting with some mates in a shisha bar, and this is at the height of the pandemic, which wasn't the most sensible thing. But we get to his football, and he's really sewn this whole Union side together and has put them up to a level which I don't think people were expecting them to play this season. They won 5-0 against Arminia Bielefeld. Kruse scored another penalty. He scored 16 out of 16 penalties now in his Bundesliga career. So if he scores another one, he will break the record of a guy called Jochen Abel, who holds the record back in the 80s. But the Bundesliga is more fun with Max Kruse. And he basically carried the Werder Bremen team that he was in two seasons ago. And you saw, by the way, that they were nearly relegated last season, what happened without him. And I have to say, I've been around quite a bit this week. I was in Hoffenheim last Monday to watch Union play there. And Kruse, the way that he's able to play balls just first time, he just sees things before the rest of his teammates. And yeah, he's on another level, I would say. And I think he's going to help push Union up into the top half, which will be a real great success story.
I mean, my kind of wild man, going 10 miles an hour too fast and eating one too many Kinder Buenos. That's the sort of edginess that I subscribe to.
Well, he's also appeared on the Turkish version of The Voice. So, I mean, there's a lot sort of, you know.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, he did. He turned up. You said he's not. No one's suggesting he's unprofessional. I mean, Yogi Löw has suggested that he's unprofessional.
In his defense, I remember a time in his career when he went and hired a personal fitness trainer to get fitter before a season because he thought he wasn't in good enough shape. I bat for Max Kruse.
I mean, man gets personal trainer as well. I'm just saying, like
professional athlete
to get an extra good shape, Max. You've got to offset your Nutella addiction, okay?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Anyway, look, this will do for part two. We'll do La Liga in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Lars Sivertsen taking up the La Liga reins today. Talk to us about Real Sociedad beating Granada 2-0. Very strange not to start with Barca or Real, and big stories from both those games. But Sociedad are top, but they beat a Granada team who really didn't want the game to go ahead.
No, they really didn't. I think this will tap into your sort of five-a-side or Sunday league sensibilities, Max, because they were really sort of scrounging around looking for players in the end. And for the full detail of this story, I have to say, go to Sid's column on the website, which you should do every week anyway. But, I mean, it was an extraordinary situation because according to the sort of protocol that all the clubs in La Liga agreed on back in September, the rule is that in the event of a COVID case at a club, the games would still go ahead as long as they could name a 13-man squad and only five of the players have to be first-teamers, but those five need to be on the pitch at all times, is the sort of protocol that everyone agreed with. Now, Granada played away in the Europa League and Cyprus last week, and they had a bit of an outbreak in the squad, which was bad because their plan was to go to Cyprus and then go straight to San Sebastian for the game against Real Sociedad. So they'd brought extra players in that squad. And because they had an outbreak in the squad, the league informed Granada that it wasn't enough for players to test negative. They could only go and play against Real Sociedad with players and staff who were negative and had antibodies against COVID, or players who tested negative and had not been to Cyprus. Now, given they took extra players to Cyprus, this was not ideal, and it left them really, really struggling to field any kind of team. So, just as Sid writes in the column, is in the starting 11, there were four debutants, one man making his first league start, two making their second. In the 19-man squad, you had 12 who'd never been called up before. There was a winger at fullback, a centre forward in midfield, and a striker who hadn't seen his teammates in 3 weeks, and kids everywhere. So it was a little bit farcical, really.
Yeah, sort of one of those games where, you know, before kickoff, you're sort of shaking hands with the other centre mid going, what's your name? Dave. All right, yeah. Dave. Brilliant.
That's really what it was. They had to get guys from the B team, from the under-19 team. The manager wasn't there. The assistant manager wasn't there. The physio wasn't there. They were without their first, second, third and fourth choice goalkeeper. Which obviously is not the situation they want to be in. So they had an 18-year-old, Angel, in goal, who made his debut. Saved a pen, by the way, and did very well overall. But I guess I'm wrestling with myself a little bit in terms of, on the one hand, it is farcical that you have a game like that go ahead in one of the top leagues in world football. That seems to be something that should be it should be possible to avoid it. It should be able to them to say, listen, because of the way this is has broken for us, we can't field a proper team. But there is another side to it, which is that this is the protocol everyone agreed to, and they were within that. Now, interestingly, they had the protocol does say they had to have five first team players on the field at all time. They started with seven, of which they substituted three. So they did actually end the game with less than the required number of first-team players on the field, which means Real Sociedad could complain and presumably be awarded a 3-0 walkover win there. But they won 2-0 in the end, so I mean that wouldn't change much. They would have one better goal difference if they did.
Lars's dog excited on the Granada news. I mean, actually, Granada...
Absolutely furious.
Granada played okay, and considering Granada played okay, didn't they? And didn't they miss a penalty themselves when
they did.
When Sociedad were down to 10 men? They could have got something
played
out of the game.
Well, I think, is generous. Okay. Played well is generous, but they didn't have a lot of chances. They've got their young goalkeeper, playing his first game at this kind of level, had a very good day, and I think won himself a lot of friends. But they had something like two shots in the entire game. But as you said, they were just in inverted commas 2-0 down, and they did have a late penalty which could have made a game of it. But really, there was never really much doubt of where it was going.
Question from Jason here. Hey Max, big fan. Thanks, Jason. Important question. Real Madrid is shit, right? I watched the Valencia match, and I haven't seen such shambolic defence since my ASO days. AYSO is a youth league here, which is in New York, comprised mostly of kids whose mums just want them to run a bit every other weekend. They conceded a hat-trick of penalties last in this game.
That's a very harsh way of describing Sergio Ramos.
And Rafael Varane, yeah.
Rafael Varane. No, listen, yeah, they weren't good. And you don't...
Lola, stop.
Sorry. They... Sorry, the dog's gone really weird. Listen, you don't expect Real Madrid to lose against sort of an almost asset-stripped Valencia. I mean, we mentioned it on the pod this autumn. Valencia have had this sort of situation, but because of no European football, because of no COVID, they've had to cut budget by something like 40%.
Ouch!
She's just really worried about Valencia, I think.
So. The asset stripping of Valencia. Who knew a dog could be so upset by the asset stripping of Valencia?
Yeah, I mean, but they've sold something like... They've gotten rid of something like six players over the summer, who I think would all be regular starters. And so obviously they're not in a very good place. Fans are very frustrated. You'll remember they hired a mariachi band to sort of follow board members around town, which I think is an amazing form of protest. So the context of this thing is that Real Madrid are going away to a team who are just not in a very good place at all, and they lose 4-1. Of course, that's slightly spectacular. Now, there's still a couple of things to get into here. That Real Madrid back four, I think, is not a back four you really want to see. I think Lucas Vazquez is not really a... And not really a right back. Varane is having a weird time in his career. And Marcelo, I mean, we're getting to this place with Marcelo, and all the nine league games Zidane has lost since he came back to Real Madrid, Marcelo started in. Now, this might be sort of shades of the sort of Gareth Bale stats. It's not just his fault, but he is a fullback who... He has a style of play that you do wonder that now with his sort of slightly diminishing physical capabilities, if that's a problem for him. And if you add on that sort of slightly ropey back four, or certainly back four that you wouldn't fully trust, you have no Casemiro in front of them to look after them. You have Isco in midfield who doesn't offer you a ton off the ball. It ended up being a little bit of a mess. Having said all that, a hat-trick of penalties, as you mentioned. I mean, two of the penalties were sort of handballs, which are a little bit random. The penalty Marcelo gave away, I think, maybe wasn't a penalty at all. So it was a slightly odd game, but certainly this is a Real Madrid lineup I don't think we're going to see a ton of times this season, and I wouldn't trust them to get a lot of results with that 11 out.
Barcelona beat Real Betis 5-2, ending their four-game winless run in the league. Messi started on the bench. Ronald Koeman said he would have started if he hadn't had any discomfort. We all know who he is. I don't have any doubts about him. Should we read any more into that? Because I am reading more into that. Just the sight of Messi on the bench, is, you know, even if he only had one leg, is sort of extraordinary.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I saw a couple of headlines going, you know, Messi has been benched. Listen, the guy is 33 years old. He's played an awful lot of games. Barcelona had just gone on a run of playing something like, I think, 6 games in 19 days, Messi starting in all of them. I mean, if you're sort of 33-year-old, the talisman is... If you're starting him every minute of every game, sooner or later his body's just going to break down. So I think the responsible thing is to rest him. I think it's like the unfortunate thing is that they didn't play that well without him. And they were creating some chances. They weren't really putting them away. Griezmann, again, if you feel with Griezmann, that was kind of his moment to shine there. He had a few chances, didn't put them away. Messi came on at halftime, and this is great because it was he immediately had an assist, which will not count as an assist. And by that, I mean he had one of those situations where he jumped over the ball and left
it
for Griezmann.
It's so good.
And everyone listening to this, if you're a regular pod listener, you know I like my numbers, I like my stats, but it's one of those things, there'll never be a number that'll quantify what Messi did there. It was a, you know, we all know of the no-look pass, and this was the no-touch assist. It was just really, really amazing.
I think there's a large difference between a no-look pass, which is essentially completely pointless, and the dummy, which is one of the greatest skills in the game of football. And when it's so the greatest is Pele, right? When he runs past the ball and everyone falls over and he puts it wide. But it's a brilliant dummy, isn't it? Ansu Fati's injured, and that is a big blow for Barca, isn't it? 4 months out.
Yes, it is, because one thing is that he's an exciting young player who everyone's looking forward to, and as much as we talk about Barcelona being a bit of a mess, the positive thing for them is they have young Pedri looking good, they have Ansu Fati looking promising. There is sort of interesting things happening on the youth player side of stuff there. But yeah, he's picked up a meniscus injury, could be out for 4 months, and yes, he's a young, exciting player, but he's also started 6 out of 7 games in La Liga so far for Barcelona, scoring 4 goals. So because they weren't able to find any kind of money towards the end of the transfer windows, they couldn't bring Memphis in, even though Ronald Koeman really wanted him, and even if he wouldn't have cost that much. We were in a situation there that I guess that means Ansu Fati's going to play a ton of games this season, which would have been great for him, and he really looked like he was ready for that responsibility in spite of being so young. Listen, the upside is that he is super young, so he has plenty of time to recover and fulfill his potential and all of that. But it's a shame because it pauses him in what looked like it was going to be a huge, huge breakout season for him.
A couple of quick ones on Atleti and Villarreal. Villarreal are second. What's that all about?
They have a really good team. They have Unai Emery in charge, which you know, English people might be slightly suspicious of, given things sort of didn't go tremendously well. But you know, you remember I said that Valencia had been asset stripped. I mean, their midfield went to Villarreal basically, okay, with Francis Coquelin and Dani Parejo. Parejo played, Coquelin didn't. But they've got a really good collection of sort of players who you look at and you go, oh yeah, he's actually really good. A bunch of them have turned up at Villarreal, and I think Unai Emery, in a context where the linguistical issues are maybe not the same as they were at Arsenal, I don't think he's necessarily a bad coach, and I think they're definitely a team to look out for in the Champions League battle for sure.
And Atleti, João Félix, 6 goals in his last 4 appearances in all competitions.
Yeah, no, he's really. He's a guy who I think, just because of the transfer fee that was paid for him, that kind of hung over his head a little bit last season. And he's a young guy. He's his first year at Atleti. There's a lot of big changes in his life there. And maybe there were times last season where you were looking at him and thinking, well, for the money they'd paid, they were maybe expecting a little bit more right away. But he's really, really coming into his own this season now. 6 goals in the last 4 games. Seems to be enjoying playing with Luis Suarez up front there. Just looks like he's really taking not just the game, but just taking this team by the scruff of the neck and just going, this is my house now. This is João Félix's team, becoming a really dominant player for them. And you were mentioning earlier the odds of there being a surprise league winner. I mean, Atleti have got... You've got to say, they've still, after 7 games in, they've only conceded twice, but they're actually scoring a decent amount of goals going forward now. And with both Real Madrid and Barcelona looking vulnerable, this season you have to look at it and say this is a huge chance for Atletico Madrid this season.
Lars, a Norway minute. Bodo Glimt handball chat.
Just a minute. Oh my God. Bodo Glimt nearly won the league this weekend, but results elsewhere meant they haven't quite done it yet, but they are going to win the league. I think we have mentioned them on the pod before, but they are an extraordinary story. A team that has just just a very small budget, sort of lower half of the Norwegian league type budget, who's just kind of completely run away with the league, playing exciting football, scoring an absolute ton of goals. There was a big piece in the New York Times about them by, I guess, friend of the show, Rory Smith. I'm sure he's a friend of the pod.
He absolutely is, yeah.
And I looked this up. The last time Bode was mentioned in the New York Times was in 1960 because of, you know, the U-2 spy plane that was shot down over Russia. That was meant to land in Bode, so some people had come to have a look about. So, this, yeah, Bode is a very small place in the northern Norway that doesn't get mentioned a lot on the world stage. But this is the magic of football. Their team have just been an absolute delight to watch. They scored 83 goals in 24 games. I mean, this is mad. I mean, they're not a million miles off of averaging 4 goals a game. And I have to stress, this is not a team that's had a lot of external investment or anything. And if you look at the players, none of them are considered huge stars or anything. There's a, it would be going a little bit too far to call them a sort of band of misfits, but their teams have kind of come together and done something really special up there. So it was amazing stuff from Bodø/Glimt. I do have to mention, we had one of the worst handball decisions in history, I think, in the Norwegian League this weekend. I mean, I did tweet the photo, which you can see at Lars Sivertsen on Twitter. It's a handball that is, I mean, the broadcasters have measured it. It was almost 3 meters outside the area. It was 2.6 meters, roughly, almost about 3 yards outside of the penalty box. That was given as a handball. And we don't have VAR in Norway, so there was no VAR to fix it. And what we do in Norway is actually the ref will sometimes come out and talk about, you know, what's gone on. So they spoke to the ref after the game. I'm going to translate the quotes here. He said, I was not aware initially that there was a handball, but I was told on the air, you know, they communicate, the fourth official and the linesman and the ref, they have a thing, they talk. It was communicated to me. That was repeated a few times, and when I became aware it was a handball, I blew the whistle. When I had become aware of it, everyone were really far into the penalty area, and it didn't occur to me that it would be anything other than a penalty.
Players move shock.
Yeah.
A question from Axel. Can Barry talk in depth about the insane title race in Belgium?
No.
Ben says, why does Archie have a poster of shocking Rowan Atkinson vehicle Johnny English up in his flat? Brackets, thanks again for the live show.
Okay, so I can turn it round now. It's not in my room. This is in my living room. And, okay, so what's gone on here is that I ordered the poster for Patterson there, a good Adam Driver film. And then when I looked further into the package, I was like, I didn't order this, and I pulled it out, and it's the German film poster for Johnny English 3. Man lebt nur dreimal. So I thought, well, you know what? You don't usually get this kind of opportunity. So I thought, well, fuck it. I'm going to order the frame for that as well. So now every morning when I step out of my bedroom, I've got Rowan Atkinson looking at me, and it just kind of makes me smile. So, yeah.
That'll do for today's pod. Nikki, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Archie. Cheers, Lars. Thanks, Barry.
No problem.
We'll be back on Friday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.